For more than 150 years, prisoners have had the chance to work on farms inside the prison system. In early 2009, it was revealed that the government was planning to shut down this long-standing program. Once the word got out, a wave of opposition emerged from across the country, and people began organizing to defend the farms. Even as the government carries forth with their closure plans, people are continuing to fight to keep the farms running. And some of them are using civil disobedience to get their message across. Diane Dowling is one of those people. She's an organic dairy farmer living near Kingston, Ontario. She's also the president of Local 316 of the National Farmers Union in Ontario. Not far from her farm is the Frontenac Prison Farm, one of the largest urban farms in Canada. Diane joins us on the phone from her farm near Kingston, Ontario. Thanks for joining us this evening, Diane.
Thank you for having me on your program.
I know it's late for you there, and you probably get up at the crack of dawn and do farm-like things.
Yes, usually.
So we appreciate you joining us. Can you tell us, where are they at with the process of closing the prison farms?
Well, they've pretty much shut everything down. There are six prison farms across Canada, or were until very recently. One in New Brunswick, two in Ontario, both happen to be within the boundaries of Kingston, and one in each of the prairie provinces. And because they had various farming operations connected with them, they're fairly complex program, and they've been shutting down different parts since February 2009. And they now have pretty much everything closed up except for the dairy operation and the egg-laying operation at Frontenac. Primarily because we've been very actively protesting against it. And there are a couple of composting operations at a couple of the prisons, and there's an abattoir at the other prison farm in the Kingston area, Pittsburgh Institution, and that's still operating. But basically they've sold any herds that were at the farms and gotten rid of chickens and pigs and so on that were at, you know, different farms had different animals at them.
And they haven't sold any of the land off yet, so they're...
No, not to my knowledge. They've always said they have no... well, in terms of the land here in Kingston anyway, that they have no plans to sell the land. I feel that this has something to do with their plan to build regional complexes, what they call them, but I would call it a super prison. And I think they want to keep whatever land base they have intact until they decide where these regional complexes are going to go.
So how did you get involved in the fight to save prison farms, and what makes you so passionate about this issue?
Well, when it was first in the local newspaper that the prison farms were going to close, our first thought was, well, what's going to happen to the farmland? The National Farmers Union here and various other people in the Kingston area have been very active over the last decade on building the local food system. And you don't have to go very far north of Lake Ontario, which Kingston sits on the lake, to get into basically just rocks and trees. And so whatever good farmland there is very valuable in this area. And because the prison farms were established in this area anyway 50 or 60 years ago, they are in areas that now are built up all around them, and they are some of the best farmland in our region.
So you started with an interest in the farm and the land itself, and what more have you learned about the issue since getting involved in it?
Well, it's been a steep learning curve. I knew nothing about corrections before, but there are many prisons in the Kingston area, and a lot of people, you know, work there or have friends or relatives that work there, and so it's actually quite a big factor in people's lives in this area. We learned that the prison farm is probably one of their best rehabilitation and training programs that they have. Corrections always has a lot of trouble setting up employment arrangements for the inmates because it has to be able to be taught and done within the prison, and then it also can't really compete with outside private business and so on. Here's a program that, you know, successfully was changing people's attitudes and also producing food for the system. So it sort of seemed like it was a, you know, it was a good program. Why change it? And we've never been able to get what we consider to be a common sense kind of answer for why they were getting rid of it. They said that the program costs $4.1 million. That's after they've taken into account the expenses of it and then the income that's accounted for by the food products. And so for all six farms across Canada, the deficit was $4.1 million. And they said that less than 1% of inmates, and at first we thought they meant inmates that were in the farm program, but they really mean inmates, all inmates in the system, less than 1% get work after they're released on farms. And they've never said how many farm program inmates get jobs, period. Like, it really doesn't matter if it's a farm job or a construction job or driving a truck or working in a plant or, you know, whatever they may have come out from prison and gotten work at doing. So long as they get a job, this helps prevent them from reoffending, which is one of the goals of corrections, and I think, you know, certainly a goal for society as well.
And so, I understand they weren't revealing to you the recidivism or the repeat of reoffending rates or anything like that. They weren't sharing much information about what was happening on the farms.
No, they, you know, it seems odd that they can tell us that less than 1% got jobs on farming, but they can't say how many, you know, of the people that were on the farm program got a job, period, or what their recidivism rate is. And people who have worked for corrections and have now retired tell me that, you know, as one woman said, they've got figures on everything. So if they're not telling you that, it's not that they don't have it, it's they don't want to release it. And I mean, informally, the other inmates and the staff that I've talked with have said, you know, they know that people don't come back to prison from after they've been on the farm program. At least, you know, those that stuck with it for a reasonable amount of time. And I've heard that the Crown attorney for this region, who the recently retired Crown attorney, told a lawyer friend of mine that he never prosecuted an inmate who had worked on the prison farm. You know, he never had saw someone come before him in court, someone who had been involved in the farm program. So, I mean, yes, they were in prison initially for something, but once they had worked on the farm, none of the people that came before him in court were people from the farm program. And also, another thing that he considered remarkable was that, you know, there's lots of tools and things around on a farm that could be used as a weapon, and he never had a case of someone, you know, using equipment from the farm as a, you know, for any kind of trouble within the prison. So I think it's, you know, a pretty good endorsement of the program that it's helping change people's attitudes, and that's what the, you know, inmates who have been released have told us too. That, and also the staff say that you can see people become less hyper and less anxious and less angry as they work on the farm.
So, in light of that kind of information, and what do you think the government's real motivations are for wanting to close the farms?
I don't know, and that's what I mean about, you know, we've never gotten what I would call a meaningful response from them. They've told us these things that they, you know, inmates don't get farm jobs, therefore the farm training is irrelevant, therefore we need to get rid of the program. I don't buy that. I think that the cutting of the program came out of a strategic review of the department, which they were supposed to find ways to cut costs. It may be that there was no one to speak for the program at head office, and it was offered up. It may be that they've visualized the land being needed for these super prisons, and therefore they wanted to clear the deck for that. It may be that somebody, for instance, the Frontenac Institution is completely surrounded by industrial, residential, and commercial development in Kingston. They may visualize selling off at least parts of it for development. It would be very, very valuable, but it would also be, a tragedy for the preservation of farmland in this area to have it paved over. Farmers who are familiar with it say that, on a bad year, a few miles north, you wouldn't get a crop or you'd get a poor crop, but there at the farm, you'd get the usual two or three crops of hay or a good crop of corn or whatever, and this is the kind of land that we may need in the future to feed ourselves within this area, when peak oil means that, we can't continue to import produce from 2,000 kilometers away.
I think it's interesting, too, if they're talking about saving that $4 million that they lose on the farm. At the same time, the prison budget has gone up by 30%, and there's a lot more money for capital projects in the prison budget. It seems incongruent with that argument.
Completely. And the previous Minister of Public Safety, Peter Van Loan, we had a meeting with him over a year ago, and he acted as if this $4.1 million was, a huge, huge amount of money. And, yes, considering the projections for the cost of their so-called tough-on-crime legislation, in the billions of dollars, worrying about the $4 million is kind of silly, really, and or irrelevant. And I don't think that... And they also wouldn't show us any detailed accounting of it. And people are very curious to know, like, do they get any credit for it being a rehabilitation program, for example? Or do they get any credit, while the men are working on the farm, they don't need guarding. They don't need guards there. They're the staff of the farm are supervising them. So is there any credit, for the other roles besides training that the or employment that they're providing? So it's, it's just a whole lot of unanswered questions about it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with them if they all do, successfully shut down. But another thing about these farms is that they, part of their role is they actually provide food like milk and vegetables and meat for the prison system itself to feed the prisoners. So what's going to happen if that food stops going into the prison system? What's going to happen with the whole food system within the prison after that?
Right. Well, we know, for example, that the milk that's supplied by Frontenac, they put the contract on the government contracting website called Merck's, and the contract was offered at about $1 million, and I guess in the end they signed a contract for, I think it was $1.3 million to provide per year to provide the milk products that the prison farm is now providing for them. And so we have that specific number for milk, and then Frontenac Institution also has 7,000 to 9,000 laying hens. So there's also the value of the eggs produced there, which would be a separate contract. And because they've never shown us the accounting, we have no idea whether $1.1 million is comparable to what they were already credited for the milk. We were told that the milk was actually sold into the system below market value. So presumably now they're buying it at full market value, including the cost of processing, which the inmates used to do, as well as milking the cows. They pasteurized and bagged the milk. That now these things are all being paid to outside processing companies. So it's, to my mind, it's bound to cost more.
And my understanding is because, the prison farms are run by Corcan, which is sort of the internal industrial, part of the prison system, this kind of tendering was not subject to things like NAFTA, but now it will be, because you have to put things out. And
that's right. Yeah, everything that goes on Merck's has to be NAFTA compliant. So, you know, maybe not for the milk, but maybe for other food products, the food could be coming, you know, presumably from wherever they can get it the cheapest, and could be coming from outside of the country, which, of course, involves a lot of food miles and perhaps questionable food quality and so on.
And I understand that you've gone and talked to the Correctional Service of Canada, different government officials, and one of the things that you did was present different proposals, and some of them around different sustainability ideas as to, you know, ways to keep the farms open. What did you propose, and how did they respond to you?
We presented a brief to the Commissioner of Corrections, so that's the top employee for corrections, Don Head, in early July, and we outlined various ideas, which we had been talking about in general terms for you know, for the entire campaign, but that there were lots of opportunities for involving green technology in the farm. There's something called a biogas digester, in which they use the manure from the herd plus food waste, which of course they would have through the prison kitchens. And you can create heat and energy from it. So there would be an opportunity to make money, or to save money, certainly, on heat and energy costs, as well as we proposed that, you know, they could work with the local college. St. Lawrence College in Kingston is quite an innovator in the alternative energy field, and they could work with them on, say, small demonstration projects for solar power or wind power. We understand that the college would love to have places to have these demonstration projects set up, and of course they could, you know, benefit the farm and the prison in general. As well, the college has had a research project on artisanal cheese, so specialty cheeses, which is becoming you know, a growing field, certainly in eastern Ontario and in other places in Canada, I'm sure. So both of these fields would be growing employment opportunities. So if inmates had experience in these areas, this would be a plus, I think, upon their release to be on their resume.
I imagine they said no or to that proposal.
Yeah, that's right. We asked them for a 3-month moratorium while the closures, while we actively explored these with CSC. We offered to turn our energies, which are going now into fighting them, turn those energies into, you know, cooperating and working with them. And I'd much rather be doing that. We asked that Mr. Head take this proposal to the minister. He said that he would, and he wrote us a letter saying that he had spoken with the Minister of Taves, and that they, you know, while they appreciated our proposal, they were continuing with their plan of closing the prison farms.
So something else that you have been doing and has been organized there in Kingston is a little bit of civil disobedience to protest the farm closures. Can you tell us a bit about how people got to that point and what's been happening with the civil disobedience?
Well, I guess, you know, we've been writing letters and signing petitions and having demonstrations in public meetings and trying to get meetings with the relevant politicians and bureaucrats, you know, basically trying to go through all the proper channels. But given the lack of meaningful response from the government and from the bureaucracy, we have resorted to what we would call civil disobedience, or, you know, but in a peaceful way. Our first mild effort at that was a march from we had held a rally in a church on June the 6th, and Margaret Atwood spoke at it. She led about 1,000 people down the streets of Kingston to the regional headquarters, and we went on to the regional headquarters property and taped our manifesto to the door. It was a Sunday afternoon, and there was, you know, there were only a couple of security guards around, but you know, in a sense, we were trespassing on their property without invitation. We followed that up on July 23rd. We blockaded traffic into the regional headquarters. We are anticipating trying to block the cattle trucks when they come to take the cattle away from the dairy herd. And so this was kind of a practice run and for people to sort of develop confidence and a repertoire of techniques to use. So for about 2 hours or 2.5 hours, we blocked traffic into the regional headquarters parking lot, mostly to draw attention. You get national media coverage when you do something like this. And also to say again how we're very frustrated by the lack of response from the government, the lack of explanations or figures or information. So as I say, the dairy herd is being auctioned a week from tomorrow. It's scheduled for August the 10th at an auction facility in Waterloo, Ontario, which is probably about a four-hour drive from Kingston. Anyway, they no matter where it was, they'd have to truck the cattle out of the farm to go to the auction center, and we intend to block the trucks from going in if we get enough notice of them coming, or block them going out if they are already in before we are aware of it. And that's just to say how, you know, committed we are to this issue and how the herd staying at the farm really represents the guts of the program at Frontenac.
Well, thanks so much for joining us and sharing a little bit more about your insights in the prison farms and your ongoing actions to help stop the closure of those prison farms. So thanks so much for joining us, Diane.
Okay, thank you very much, Emily.
We've been speaking with Diane Dowling. She's an organic dairy farmer who's part of the campaign to save the prison farms from closure. For more information about the fight to save the prison farms, there's two websites you can check out. There's saveourfarms.ca and saveourprisonfarms.ca.